Mise en scène.
Mise en scène. February 8th, 2022. So, yeah, John, I got to tell you, sorry I hadn't called you the book you ordered.
Yeah.
That
When We Cease to Understand the World.
What's that again?
When We Cease to Understand the World.
Right. It's like all zeros on hand, and they're like 3,000 ordered from every different warehouse. So it's like the big thing. So why is that?
Because it was featured on the New York Times Book Review podcast. That's where I heard it.
Right.
And it was the only one that was like top five fiction books of the year. It was the only one that was interested me because they were like, yeah, it's about scientists. It's a literary take on scientists.
Really?
So, yeah, that... And I actually didn't have to wait for the book. I just got the audiobook version, which is just digital, and right. That can never be on back order.
Right, right.
But I got really excited when I called you to order it because of the first chapter. It sort of takes a turn at the end where it's a lot of like Heisenberg, and it gets into the quantum stuff, the quantum theories, Heisenberg, and what's the other guy's name? Schrodinger, and. That stuff's okay, but it has less facts, and it's more just like snippets of their lives, which was okay. But I was really kind of taken aback by this one fact in the first chapter, which following, well, okay, I'm gonna drop the pretense that we're doing this naturally. I think it was. This is the problem with doing audiobooks, though, is in my mind the scientist's name is Huber, but I don't. I think you're right. It's probably somebody else. One of the fathers of sarin gas.
Yeah. It could. And I see his picture in the Encyclopedia Britannica or something.
Yeah.
I've seen it, and I read it. And I remember the story. They have a big party or something, and she goes, and
his wife,
and he's Jewish, of course, and Prussianized Jew, right? Which is the ultimate, right? I mean,
yeah.
They're Prussians before they're Jewish. And, yeah, he's this great scientist, and he delivers all this, sarin to the world and other stuff, too.
Well, yeah, he eventually ends up winning the Nobel Prize for developing the chemical complex that gathers nitrogen from the air.
Right, and went from there to, yeah, so it's not Huber. And then went from there to nerve gas, but like
no, said, that came after nerve gas first, and then later in life.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's sarin gas, First World War. It's towards the Second World War,
right.
Where they're trying to.
Right. So when is his beautiful Jewish wife kill herself? When she?
That's after the first. Yeah, during the First World War. Yeah.
And so he survives the suicide of his wife. And
tormented by it for the rest of his life.
Loyally goes on, and now he's into peaceful concerns, and now we have...
No, that's not true. He develops the gathering of nitrogen from the air as a substitute to make sure they never run out of gunpowder.
Of course! Of course!
So it's...
God, that's great.
It was based on a military idea, but then later it became used as fertilizer.
So this is great literature. So what's the guy's name?
I think it's Huber,
I mean the writer.
Oh, Labatut is his last name. And Benjamin. Benjamin Labatut.
Yeah.
He lives
in
Chile, apparently.
Interesting.
At least that's what the end of his book suggests.
Right. Well, you know, he read this story and went, oh, yeah, great, man. Everybody loves you. You're a good Jew, and you're really doing a lot of stuff. And your beautiful young wife just kills herself.
Yeah.
One night.
Well, yeah. He comes back after he's just killed thousands of Frenchmen with sarin gas, and he's he gets invited to dinner by the Tsar, and he gets his accolades, and he comes home and they have a big party, and his wife is like, "What have you wrought on the world?" And he just ignores her. He's like, "Yeah, war is war. People are going to be people. This is a better way to kill people. I mean, what do you want from me?" And at the end of the party, she's had a couple, and she, in the morning, she walks out into the garden and shoots herself in the chest with a revolver, and then he's haunted by it for the rest of his life. But it was kind of fascinating. The fact that really caught my attention was this thing with the nitrogen, and about how during this time, the First World War, there's like 1.6 billion people on the planet. And after the wars, people would come back and they were basically starving. You know, it was hard to grow a large enough quantity of food. So with this nitrogen process, he won the Nobel Prize because he was essentially the man who got bread from the air, right. You know, because he gathered nitrogen to create fertilizers, which in no small part has been part of the effect of how we're now able to have 7 billion people on the planet. Right. And he had this fact that more than likely over 50% of the nitrogen in your body has been artificially created.
Right.
And that when I heard that, I was just kind of like, whoa. You know, because it goes into one of my favorite like wormholes of like, okay, what is and isn't artificial? You know? Like, what does artificiality really mean? But it's also, yeah, just this.
It's science fiction.
Yeah, it's kind of science fiction.
You were in planet Earth, and we've got this little aquarium here, and we're just manufacturing our own, stuff. And, of course, as you know, gentle listener, right out the door we have Simplot Phosphate Factory, which does both phosphorus and nitrates. You know, that's what you get out of ancient seas, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I remember talking to a BLM officer that oversaw the project out in to the east of us, where the phosphate beds are, and said, you know, I feel fairly comfortable, at least overseeing somebody that's making something that is allowing people to live, right?
Mm.
And so, yeah. So, yeah, it goes into that. So,
we should feel comfortable.
I feel better about myself as a BLM overseeing officer than I'm actually, helping the environment. And because, as you know, there's a tremendous amount of selenium that is a byproduct of basically when they open up these big phosphate beds of marine skeletons, the rainwater will take the selenium out of the matrix and bring it into the water faster than anything else for some reason. And
so they would open up a pit and just let it rain on it for a while?
Well, they don't try. No, they open up the pit and they take the ore out, but the excavated interface, so to speak, the skeleton of the rock there still has all this naked selenium there, and so the rainwater comes down. Yeah, when it gets to Pocatello and the Simplot factory, that selenium's in there, and that's burned off into the air. Which should make you feel better.
Yeah, right.
Jonah's living in Northwest Pocatello. Yeah, yeah. but anyway,
especially on those really burny days,
foggy days. Yeah. So, that's God, the tremendous irony. So he has created a literary work out of these disparate facts.
Well, or. Yeah, I mean, seemingly disparate. I don't know. They're really fun places to start with characters, I think. You know,
right.
And it's exciting to see somebody do that in a way that seems literarily relevant to me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, you know, there's, I mean, look, you can just talk about all kinds of people. I've been looking through Gertrude Stein recently, and she's like, as a writer, you can find anybody interesting. Like, there's a possibility for anybody to be interesting, but to take on people who are truly, you know, kind of mad geniuses in their own right, and then doing stories about them, it's kind of... And I think he knew that was part of the hook, you know, but it seems like I don't know. It got me excited. I liked it.
Brilliant. I mean, it's not like he's doing an Irving Stone historical novel. He's just He's just like, doing
it. It's actually quite a short book.
So are there a lot of, does it stay on one level, or does he do any, stream of consciousness or introspection, or?
It gets pretty introspective, yeah. It definitely gets into their mind space.
Really?
Yeah.
Right.
But, like I said, that, to me, was possibly the weakest part of it.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's, gotta look through your beer choices.
Oh, I came upon a good one right there.
Oh, I brought this one.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, man. Yeah. No, that's tremendous, man. What a great genre, you know, just to invent it. And so, yeah, and now we have to spell his last name.
Yeah, Labatut. I think he is a
Labatut.
I think he is a Jewish transfer to right. Chile.
Right, right.
I think he, his lineage right. is Jewish.
Right. Well, as a contretemps to this, I've been reading the biography of Leonard Cohen, who most people don't know, but he did write the song Hallelujah.
Yeah.
Covered by so many people. When he's like 75.
He was 75 when he
at least.
Wow.
The biography, he's like 70 when she starts interviewing him. Mm. But all I can tell you about this is, do you remember the Velvet, you ever heard of the Velvet Underground?
Of course, yep.
Lou Reed,
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
Nico would not sleep with Leonard Cohen, no matter whether he wrote Suzanne or not. So in 1967, Judy Collins picks up Suzanne by a little Jewish guy from Canada named Leonard Cohen, and it's like on the airways everywhere. It's like the hippie anthem, man, because it's got the I Ching, it's got herbalism, it's got everything, it's got astrology, it's got everything in it, man. And but I was astounded to read it that this is I'm Your Man, The Life of Leonard Cohen by Sylvie Simmons. I was astounded that Nico slept with Jimi Hendrix. I mean, they all.
So Nico was in the Velvet Underground.
Nico was the 6-foot-tall German Welt goddess.
I don't think I've ever seen a...
I mean, she talked like a man. And, but these Lou Reed lyrics, right?
Yeah.
And Lou Reed, of course, is like Leonard Cohen. He's like 5'4 and like 115.
Yeah.
But and since she slept with Lou Reed, Leonard thought he had a chance, right? But what I'm astounded is that Jackson Browne,
yeah,
is in New York at the age of 18 and somehow gets linked up and walks up, knows, here's Andy Warhol says, look, we need a, you know, backup musician for Nico to do her own album. And he bangs on the door, and Nico looks at Jackson Browne. Jackson Browne's 18 years old, and says, you're hired, both for being my boyfriend and for being my accompanist, right? And you're going, wait a second, man. So what I learned from this book is, in 1966, 67, 68, everybody is sleeping with everybody else's girlfriends, man. It's like astonishing.
Especially if you're in the music business.
If you were of the select, right? Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I'm saying. Jackson Browne, Leonard Cohen. It was like, I mean, I'm reading this, I'm going, you gotta be kidding me. But it brings me to the very important point that creative people love to hang out with creative people.
Yeah.
And if they are at a certain level where they know how to really do, you know, get the job done.
Yeah.
That's who you hang out with, man. And the other, positive side, I mean, all these people just loved each other, supported each other. There was no bitterness, you know, no jealousy at all, man. I mean, who's Jimi Hendrix going to be jealous of? Who's Bob Dylan going to be jealous of, right? It's like, no, man, come to the party, man. So, yeah. Anyway, that's my review.
That sounds amazing, but because it sounds amazing, it makes me skeptical. It's like, as soon as I hear it, I'm like, it sounds like a romanticization.
Only you! Only you! And I swallowed this hook, line, and sinker, man. Sylvie's got me all believer, man. Yeah. They would walk into recording sessions and just invite each other to sit down. You know, I mean, that's well known. Just
come in
and sit down. I mean,
yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, that's...
But trading girlfriends, man, it's like... That was really astonishing. But, yeah, man, I don't think there were 3 years like 1967 and 1970, you know.
I think there's something weirdly honest about that scene you have where, you know, he shows up and then she's like, okay, you're my backup and you're my boyfriend. It's like there's something weirdly honest about the fact that you're acknowledging the
You're
fact
what that, I want right now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, it's not just anybody can be a musician, right? But you walked in, you look good. I'm acknowledging that I'm doing this for two reasons.
Right.
Not just one reason, right. You know.
And Jackson Browne's a great artist.
Well, yeah.
That's the other crazy
thing. How much was he helped out by being hired as a, you know, as an
18-year-old? I don't know. So. He wrote a song called These Days when he's 15. 15 years old, man, and I learned it when I was like 20, like 10 years later.
Yeah.
And it's a great song. He wrote it when he was 15. And he's just a California kid. For those that don't know, he wrote songs to the Eagles. Running down the road, loosen my load. I got seven women on my mind. He wrote that.
Two that want to stone me.
Or... One that wants to blow me. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah, that's not right. But yeah, the talented people just...
The sixes just off the dime.
Right.
I was just trying to improvise.
That's
like,
a better line, like, man. Like, the sixes off the dime, man. Now I'm going to write that down.
No, don't do that.
No, I am, because I'm just stealing.
No, well, you see, this is just what improvising is about.
Six is on the dime, man. Because dime is an easy rhyme.
It is, as you've just proven. As you have proven.
You heard it tonight, sports fans. Joan and Will start their first collaboration on a great Western rock and roll song, man.
I'd love to do a song that I just had to improvise every night. It was like a song, and then you just never learned the lyrics, and you just sort of made them up. Right. Kind of like poetry, but like funnier, you know? It's like you just get, well, I don't know. That's
Have
just
you ever done
improv
it?
Comedy. No, but I've gotten kind of fascinated with it lately.
Well, just between me and you, in my career, at least 200 brilliant young people have had that same attitude to songwriting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the song always changes.
Yeah.
And on top of that, they're wearing different clothes and they're in different states of insecurity and duress every time I see them. But other than that, they're going somewhere, man. Art is all about ritual, man. Art is the essence of ritual. Kabuki theater, stylization. Finding the rough material and finding a style.
So you don't think improv is art then? You don't think it's a...
No, I don't.
I mean,
if it's brilliant and it works, yeah. But you have to be able to repeat it. For one thing, I've never heard improv that has the depth. I mean, there's no way because you're extemporizing.
It can't have the depth.
Yeah.
Or if it does have depth, it only gets there by luck.
And it happens, and you know, jazz musicians you'll do it jamming, but you think that you just played the greatest music ever, and I know all the great musicians of time have done this, and then you listen to the track, and it's like, oh man, there's a whole bunch of pretty muddy tracking through here, man, where everybody's stumbling around looking, and then you hear something again, yeah. No, I mean, that's the whole thing. I was reading Mimesis by Auerbach, and he just talks about how
Is that mimesis?
Thank you, Jonah! Okay. Thank you! Mimesis!
I'm just making sure.
Jonah is in Idaho. And I haven't gotten out of Idaho for like 70 years. But that's what Auerbach says, is that, you know, he's talking about Proust and Virginia Woolf, how you're continually, human beings are continually recreating themselves, reorienting themselves to reality and the information that's coming in about themselves, right, in the past, and also in reference to what's going on right now.
Right.
So you're constantly doing that.
And you're saying because that is so human,
you have to edit.
That's not art, because art is the ritual part, the part that can stand the test of time, not the constant changing of the self, which is going to happen anyway.
Right.
I actually like that argument. I'm in favor of it.
Yeah, well, it's got to fit on a page, man. It's got to be, but that's the whole difference between, the stand-up geniuses that I've seen. Well, I haven't seen a lot of them, Jonah, but I've seen like 5 or 6 or 7, and they could come in here and light it up, man.
Yeah.
And but they were all severely challenged by too much information coming in all the time, and they just couldn't really. And they would actually
tell me. Can you say that in a different way?
They couldn't. That
No, could you say that in a different way? I feel like that maybe there is an alt to that. Challenged by the information coming in all the time. I mean, there's always information coming in all the time, so
right.
Anybody could choose to be challenged by that.
But they do not have the moral or historical strength to say, okay, I'm going to face the fact that this is pretty chaotic, and I'm going to formalize it, ritualize it, put it into a form that has shape, and something going on. But they don't like that, because that's the whole fun. Because, again, it's the whole I've just noticed this about human beings, their fascination with what destroys them. They love the fact they are out of control and getting 10,000 ideas in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Where I get one every 2 or 3 days.
Well, that's probably not true.
That's probably pretty close, man. Pretty close. I get a lot of them, but the point is remembering them and how they fit into some sort of a pattern. But no, the older I get, I just think, man, art is all dance, form, and ritual. I mean, that's what separates it from chaos. But anyway, you've got to edit out. The improv is great, and then you stop back and you just kind of say, okay, what can I do with this?
Right? Yeah. No, I think that was quite good. And I'm sorry I actually interrupted your previous train of thought, because I think you were going to something good, but I just had to get something in.
So. Really? What the heck was it?
I don't remember now.
Something I said had promise? That wasn't didactic? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's all didactic.
Yeah. But there's no doubt, going back to Leonard Cohen, and what I was thinking about it was that the reason is that artists need other people. They feed off other creative people, and they can't feed off losers. They can't feed off hangers-on, and they can't feed off record producers or even editors, man. They've got to have cool people. The interesting thing about this book was Leonard Cohen runs into Patti Smith in New York when she's like 15 years old, and she's like skinny in a dirty t-shirt sleeping in the street, and he starts telling everybody she's a genius just because what she would say to him. She's a genius. And he was right about that. I'm not a big fan of Patti Smith. Everybody thinks she is, right?
I don't really know that much about her.
I don't either, because we live in the West and she's in the East. But anyway, she had legs. I mean, she had a great career. And
well, it's so weird that how young they started back then. I mean,
yeah,
it is true. It's remarkable when you meet a young person who is that self-possessed, but. At the same time, I still would be skeptical, especially because, I don't know, I didn't get a start when I was young. You know, it's like it would make me, I don't know, maybe that's me being too cynical or being too, maybe that's exactly the kind
of... But you did it. You went to New York.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of.
It took a lot of courage, man.
Yeah.
I went to L.A. when I was like 20. And it was like, no, really, this is just too big for me, man. I mean, I'm just not into the scene. And I just went back to Idaho, you know. And for me, going to New York would have been like, okay, wait a second, man. You're going to live on the street. You're going to, like, play the guitar. You're going to try to sell your short stories or whatever, or yeah, whatever you're doing.
See, that, yeah, I mean, I never did
I mean,
that.
It's like, are you kidding me, man? That's, like, hopeless. But Patti Smith is like, truly was sleeping on the street at 15 and talking to people and talking about reading, you know, Rambo and Lorca and stuff. And,
you know, right? the classic poets, the romantic poets who I think are bullshit.
Oh, no! Oh, no! Oh, no!
Well, you know, Rambo, I don't know. I just don't.
Oh, Rambo is the greatest.
I don't.
Oh, the illuminations are so spectacular, man.
I don't.
They're so spectacular because the strange thing about it is that he was reading Greek and Latin in the classic style when he's like 8 or 9 years old. And Les Illuminations.
Okay, but why does this matter? Why do these matter? Why do these ancient...
Well, because Les Illuminations is like the most beautiful imagistic poetry of all time, man. You got to read Rambo's Illuminations. They are so beautiful. They're prose poems, maybe 100 words. And they've got the classic, you know, Latin, French lucidity and simplicity. They're so wonderful. And, you know, you just don't read them. You just don't read the stuff this like this in English or American or German. It's just not there, man. It's got to happen in the pure Latin. And that's... This is an interesting thing. Spanish is not Latin. English is not Latin. And German isn't Latin. French is the closest one to the Latin classical style of, you know...
Isn't Italian the closest?
No. It's Germanic, too. It's totally Germanic.
Okay, well...
It rocks along, man. French has got this kind of staid, you know, it's the only language I know, and I can tell you it's true, man.
It just, what you're saying just reminds me of... That's Spanish.
That's Spanish. That's Italian. And the high syllabic beat of English. French is like, you know, après le déluge.
Après le déluge,
the Easter Bunny comes out and looks at the rainbows. That's Rambo. It's like just this.
The Easter Bunny
comes, well, out, I was kind of...
comes out and looks at, oh, color me so impressed.
Le Lapin. It actually wasn't the Easter Bunny.
After the flood, the Easter Bunny comes out and looks at the rainbows. The most beautiful poetry I've ever heard.
Hanging from the spider webs. Oh my gosh. This has got to be the high point of all our podcasts.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Maybe it just get better the less and less we give a fuck.
Okay, when's your birthday?
What, yours is like the 14th, right?
Yeah, mine's 18th.
Oh, 18th.
Yeah.
We're right next... I'm 19.
You're going to get a copy of Rambo's Illumination. Man, and you're just going to love it, man.
All right.
Gosh darn, okay. Unfortunately, I have a direct order of mine.
There's a scene in Immortality. I was going to bring up Kundera because...
Yeah, yeah.
Because he brings up Rambo, and he's like... There's the older gentleman. He's trying to convince his daughter that Rambo is the best, and he goes back and he reads Rambo, which he hadn't done since he was in his 20s, and he's like, he has a completely different perspective on it. He's like, well, why did I actually care so much about Rambo? It was because what people of his generation cared about. That was essentially the argument Kinder made.
Was it Illuminations?
I don't...
Well, see, that's my favorite book. The other ones, I'm not, I don't care about that
okay,
much.
All right.
Everybody's got their best book, right?
I think probably, probably.
So, yeah, no, that's interesting.
Should we go through all the writers?
So what book was it? Was the reference to Rambo?
That was Immortality.
Immortality, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if ever a book had legs in a podcast, Immortality recurs every time. Man,
it just yeah.
Kundera smiles on us here. He does.
Yeah, he affected me so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I look up there and I see Kundera looking from the edge of this bookstore, man. Yeah.
God, he's still alive too. He's like edging up on 100. He's
still alive?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
C'est incroyable. Oh my gosh. Well, here's to Milan.
Here it is. So what
and
else?
Here's a guy named after an Italian city. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's a very particularly common Czech name, anyway. I don't think so.
Right.
Yeah. Well, his dad was a composer, and
of course.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Musician.
Really.
Yeah.
Of course.
What else can you tell us about Leonard Cohen?
He is a... The difference between Leonard Cohen and the modern trust fund kid is that his parents didn't give him any money when he decided to just become a... Jewish... And his father was very rich, hugely rich, had one of the biggest mansions in Montreal, and was a garment manufacturer.
Mm.
And of course, Leonard goes and reads Lorca when he's 16, and suddenly becomes a left-wing labor activist and is learning all these wobbly songs and playing them over and over again. So he gets no money, man.
What is a wobbly song?
International Workers of the World, you know, Roll Up Your Sleeves, and...
But why is it called wobbly?
They were called the Wobblies. It was like calling the Beatniks Beatniks. See, The Beats never call themselves Beatniks.
Right.
The right wing, snide dickheads of America put a nick on the end of it because that was Russian like, a parachik.
Ah, yeah.
Budnik. Yeah. You know, da da da, right? So Wobblies, the International Workers of the World was the socialist labor organization that miners.
So yeah. It was like a derogatory term referring to the fact that their politics were wobbly or something?
Exactly, yeah. Okay. They were drunk. Yeah, exactly. Exactly so. They were drunk all the time, yeah. Yeah, they work all day and then get drunk and talk about changing the world, right? But that's the other... Thank you for that question, Jonah. That was a cool thing. His formative musical career, he started out playing a ukulele. And in they would go to Jewish camps in like Michigan or wherever, or upstate New York. And he's from Montreal, so it's like Canada. And he is learning all these great Huddy Ledbetter songs, you know, Let the Midnight Special. And he's just turning into a left wing. So he's getting no money, man. I mean, it's wonderful. That's why he's so great. When he falls in love with Marianne in the island of Hydra, he runs out of money and he's got to go back. She's got a little boy, and he takes her back to Montreal, and he has no money. He's got to make some money to, and so that's where I've kind of quit. I've missed what happens after that, why he and Marianne break up. But Nell Cohen is just a total madman. And the other interesting line was that Judy Collins was doing her sixth album, she was really big. She was from Seattle. She was a classically trained musician, great singer, and boy, could she sing. And she had that Gaelic feel, right? And she was doing her sixth album, and she needed one, and the producer said, you need one or two more songs. And he said, well, I'm not a songwriter. So she says, well, cast around, we'll try and find a song from somebody. And somebody mentions Leonard Cohen, who's like 24 years old. And he brings her, this is a great story. She calls him up, and they meet for lunch, and all they do is get drunk and talk. 3 days later, she gets a call from somebody she doesn't even know saying, Leonard would wonder whether you'd like him to bring his guitar by and play some songs. And she said, this is when you would walk down the street and every street musician in the world would accost you with their guitar trying to get you to hear their song, right? So she said, yeah. So he comes up and he plays Suzanne, which is Suzanne takes you down to a place by the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the day forever. And the sun pours down like honey on Our Lady of the Harbor. And she shows you where to look between the garbage and the seaweed. There are heroes in the seaweed. There are children in the morning. They are crying out for love. They will be that way forever, right?
Right, okay.
24 years old. Not bad. And
makes no sense, but okay.
No, she says, well, it's a watercolor. So anyway, she says, great. And then he doesn't even, nothing happens. Then a week later, this woman shows up at her door and says, I want to talk to you about Leonard Cohen. And she comes in and they talk for a while. And then the woman leaves. And she never sees the woman again. And then about a week after that, Leonard Cohen comes and says, well, you know, do you want to work on this song? I mean, it's the most interesting thing I've ever read about how somebody approaches another relationship, right? Judy Collins is...
He sounds almost like a psychopath.
Of course! He is! Leonard Cohen was a psychopath!
Like, he planned all this. He's like, no, I'm going to say something. Wait a while, let her think on it, let her, like, reflect on it. Send another woman to talk to her about it. And then just get it more of a mystery in the back of our mind. Because, you know, there's nothing the human mind is more tantalized than mystery. You know, yeah. you're like, oh, who is this
guy? You're right, and days are going by.
Yeah, exactly.
Weeks are going by, yeah, and she wants to get this album done. Yeah. And here's this unknown little Jewish guy that's like 5'4". Right?
Well, did he learn? He just learned from his dad these practices of manipulation to become, this is how you make it in the world, son.
Right.
You don't give it all to him right away. You gotta tease it out a little bit.
It's all about time.
Yeah.
You're right, Jonah. And you know, that's what the great generals are like. They let a battle develop and then they wait. And they'll whittle on a stick, you know? And then, you know, see what the opposition's doing, you know, and how they're going to be reacting, what emotional stress they're going through.
Yeah, yeah. Let them make the emotional mistake.
Let them make the emotional mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the rest is history. And the final of that is that at 24... a Jewish businessman's son, he signs away all the rights to Suzanne for all time.
For how much?
Nothing.
For nothing?
Nothing. So when he's in Hydra, the Greek island, he has no money. There's no money coming in. That's so great, man.
But obviously it paid off for him, right? I mean, well, he went on to make how many fucking albums?
Well, it's one of the greatest songs ever. He kept writing. I mean, yeah. He knew he could.
Is it really one of the greatest songs? I mean, what you just... I remember it. I sort of remember it. And yeah, I mean, it's fine. It's fine. Well, I mean, you still need to perform it.
What you have to realize is that it did combine all these kind of like tantalizing hints of the I Ching. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. You know, there are all these little...
So it's like about a... It's like a symbolism kind of thing.
Well, you got to realize that America is this like Anglo-Saxon, you know, Germanic, locked in fascist state, basically. And all of a sudden, you've got, with the Beats and Ginsberg and Kerouac, you've got these cracks coming in, man. And you got Gary Snyder, you know, reciting Chinese poetry. And
who's Gary Snyder again?
Gary Snyder was the Japanese Zen poet, Cold Mountain. I mean, he just read the Tang poets and copied them and got their spirit. And but I'm just saying that. I mean, cracks are coming in, man. I mean, and then India, you know, incense, sitar, things are coming in from the side, and you're absolutely right. Leonard Cohen was part of that. He brought that vibe in, and people had never heard it before. If I were to make a comparison, it would be just like in 19th century France when Delacroix goes to Algeria and paints these Arabs on their steeds, you know, with their slave girls, you know, and killing dragons, and I mean killing tigers, right?
Mm.
I mean the Oriental, and something more than this Germanic Christian.
Why was he in Greece?
Why was he in Greece? I believe he first went to England, and he stayed there for a while, and then he went on, took the train down to Greece, which I did when I was a lad. And then he gets off the train, and he says, well, I want to go to an island.
What was your impression when you took the train down to Greece?
Oh, it's the greatest time of my life, man. this you just can't believe this train, Joan. It was probably, it was like of oak. It was probably like a narrow gauge. And it went down the west coast of Yugoslavia along the ocean, and it rattled. You just can't believe it. Just the whole train just rattled nonstop, man.
Can you try and make the sound of the rattling?
Because it wasn't just the... It was the rattling of all these oak and iron fittings of the... It's like, I mean, the whole thing is fucking rattling, man. And the place is packed with Yugoslavians, man, that haven't maybe bathed in like a week. And, and I mean, you're in these, and I'm like 6'3", and I'm in this like little, and it's packed, man, and it was like 2 days. Oh, my God, it's the greatest. And then you arrive in Athens, and Athens like San Diego, you know. Middle of winter, it was January 20th or something. It was like 75 degrees in Athens, and you just walk around, man. Oh, God, it was so wonderful. And I did just what he did, and then I took a ferry to Crete. And
did you get a sense of the history of the world about where civilization started? Did you feel any of those?
Oh, sure. You walk, yeah. I mean, the Acropolis is still the highest point. And it used to be a spring, apparently, but the Acropolis is still the highest point, and you've got the groves beneath there. It was just the temperature, and also being a country kid, I really do kind of like the smell of smog. I don't know what it is.
Well, not smog necessarily, smoke, like smokiness, right?
Yeah, there's just something about the smell of cities. Every city has got its own kind of smoggy smell, and I've always kind of liked it because I don't have to live in it, right? And then I went down. I mean, I don't even realize this now, but it's true. I actually, without even knowing it, did the same thing. And I got on a ferry, and this time I went to Crete, and I walked cross country. It was in my youth. I walked all the way across the country in like one day. It was like 30 miles to the southern port, and it was a little ancient Neolithic bay, and all these hippies were living in caves that had been carved out of the sandstone, right? And I got really stoned there too, man. It was like fantastic, but unfortunately I had to go back. I had to leave. But yeah, it was just...
Well,
Jonas, as I was reading this, I was thinking, why did you go back? Because your parents expected you to? Why didn't you just stay in Crete? Because you had some money. You'd pawned all your, you know, meal ticks and possessions. I was going to school. And why didn't I just stay there and hang out there for like... But Crete wasn't a hydra. What I learned from Cohen is that Hydra already had its little artist colony, you know, a lot of writers that had been published, a lot of musicians. It already had its writer's colony. The little place that I went was just a bunch of really stoned fucking, you know, American, German, Swedish, Shakespeare, you know, they were just fucking stoned all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, but...
It didn't lead to...
There were no houses. I mean, people, they were living in caves, man. That's all that was there. It was just really unbelievable, man.
Can you describe for me the interior of one of these caves?
Yes. I was invited to dinner. It was a cave. And these people had... They were all, like, frizzy-haired and wearing Afghan knitted hats and there were carpets on the floor, and they had maybe wall hangings, you know, maybe a mattress or two, and they must have had a little stove because I know they cooked me dinner and everything, but no, accommodations weren't that great, man. As I recall, I slept out on the beach, but it was still so beautiful, man. 75 degrees, Mediterranean Sea, beautiful. Oh yeah, man.
Go sleep out on the beach.
It all had to do with that. I just have always obeyed responsibilities to other people, like a fool. It doesn't get you anything, man.
Well, yeah, especially if you know. Most people only think of themselves anyway, so...
Yeah. So, yeah, so I got, after about 2 days, I thought, well, this is my winter break. It was the Christmas break, so I got back, and I got on the train. I went back to Vienna, and I finished my debacle there, but I got my credits, right, and...
I finished my debacle there.
Finished my debacle there. And only a manner that I was always possible to. Yeah, they called me Free Will, man. It's like, man, how rich is your father? And I said, my father is country doctor. I said, but you act like you're so fucking rich, man. Like, you don't care about anything. I mean, you're just a fucking idiot, actually. Now that you tell us this.
Well, you know, it's...
You're trying to hang out with the rich kids, Will, and, you know, that's... I had a great time. It was probably the best time of my life. But I should just stay there. I shouldn't have come back to America. It was just like a total disaster to come back here.
Well, that's...
This is confessional. Well, I've been reading St. Augustine. This is my confessional. Why did I come back to America? A total mistake. Total mistake. But I did get a payoff. I got a nice little bookstore and cool people. And I love the Rockies, so yeah. Yeah, you know, the Rockies...
So not a total mistake.
The Rockies are nicer than anywhere in the world. I mean, you can... There's so many people in the Alps. Greece has no water at all. You know, I mean...
Or just salt water, if you
I'm glad you kept me. I kept... So, gentle listener, Jonah kept looking at me ingenuously.
Ingenuously?
Come on, Will. Give me a break, man.
No. I felt the same thing when I left China after the fact. I was like, you know, maybe I should have just done this a little longer, you know, seen it out a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, my gut was definitely telling me to not do that. So in what sense does retroactive intelligence or guilt or whatever you want to call it, whatever you think your life... I mean, there's so many people who think about their life in terms of what might have been, you know. That's almost the classical way to define your life, is what might have been. So, if it had actually been... Why are you flexing your... Will was doing like a flexing his pecs thing, like a little titty dance. It really distracted me. I was
I was coming up with a brilliant idea.
Okay,
I was actually thinking, and I was kinestheticizing, and we talked earlier about fate, and the will and the determination, right? And that is the point, is that at that moment in time, you know, what did you will? You know, what did you decide? That's the determining thing, man. Mm. Everything else is pretty much just like chaff in the wind, man. When you decide when you're in China and you decide, no, I'm going back, that's it, man. Nothing has any other relevance or meaning, you know. So, do you remember that conversation we had about...
Fate?
Fate and will and...
I'm sure I've had this conversation with you more than
Right. Well, I read that part of my novel where the guy says, you know, boy, you've really fucked up the whole time. Every decision you made was fucked up and screwed yourself and ruined your life. And the narrator says... It was fate. It was something I had to decide. That was my decision, man. So you're absolutely right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just so irrelevant to even talk about what it might have been.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because fate is all the individual decision from moment to moment. You know, what you decide to do.
And, well, it's more like about the miscommunication with yourself to look on back on something and think you could have had a different perspective of it. You
know, exactly, like, so. Yeah, exactly so.
Yeah, yeah. Like, there's so many people, you grow up and they're like, oh my God, if I could do high school over again, I'd totally... It's like, it makes no fucking sense. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? Like, that would have been hell, you know? If you were your adult brain and then you had to relive high school, that sounds like the worst thing in the world. You're around a bunch of other people who are in high school. They don't know what... They're all insecure, you know? It's like...
Right. And you make a really nice qualifying to my idea about what you decide. Well, what you decide is, like, totally determined by your capabilities, you know?
Yeah.
There's no way... Unless God comes down and he just says, okay, you know, like did with St. Paul, you know, knock you off the horse and put you on your back.
Right,
you know, you're going to do this. Yeah, no, absolutely, man. Yeah, it's so wonderful. You know, it's just so simple. It's kind of tragic in a way, actually. And that's the essence of tragedy, is that you, yeah, what you bring to the table on a certain day that might be very important in your life, yeah, that's all you got, man.
Yeah.
But see, that's the great thing about the Joseph Campbell and the path of the hero, is that, hey, these fucking golden-haired heroes always have some, like, wise supernatural being going, no, don't do that. Mm. Do that. Right?
Yeah.
And they've got to have it, man.
You know,
because they cannot get outside their own predetermined limitations, you know.
We were going to one day try and do a podcast on The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Really?
I think we had at least discussed it.
Well, God, we got to do it, man.
Well, but I've been reading it for the past year.
Well, let's do it right
now. I got it sitting next to my toilet. Oh.
Dependable. Dependable reading material. Yeah, yeah.
But I don't feel like I've got as much out of it as most people do. I really don't. Every time I read a line, I'm kind of like, oh, yeah, I already understand that.
Right.
There's been nothing that's really blown my mind.
I don't think so either. But, I mean, just that one fact I just said is that,
yeah,
that's what myth is all about. Myth is not real, man. Myth, that's why people...
Isn't that the definition of myth?
Yeah, exactly so. And, no, and in myth... a divine being comes down and says, Will, just stay in Greece, man. Don't go back.
Right. This is where your fate is supposed to lead you.
Yeah, and you might learn something here that...
You're going to save this one young maiden who lives in this cave, and she's really the goddess of... She's the goddess of Athena, right, or whatever.
Right.
Blah, 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 blah.
Right, and she might have a sexually transmitted disease, but other than that, don't worry about it, right? But no, that's the beauty of it. Just a few.
All sexually transmitted diseases can be cured with sand in myth. You just go stick your cock in the sand and then you rub it.
You go swimming in the Mediterranean.
Oh, right, right, right. Yeah,
yeah, you swim in salt water.
Yeah, yeah. And you've got to urinate once, but only in a brief burst.
We were going on such a high plane, Jonah. But it's true, it was fine. So anyway, yeah, the simple ideas of, that's why Hero with a Thousand Faces is so great. It's got, this is like fact. I mean, every myth has got a supernatural component. And
wow,
it comes out of nowhere. You taught me how to say that.
Yeah.
You taught me how to say that. And, that's what you don't get in real life. And that's why we love fairy tales. God, this kid or girl gets a great help here. She was really fucked until that happened. And then this fairy godmother comes down and like, okay, we're going to give you a little assist here.
Yeah, I don't...
God, wouldn't it have been
wonderful...
Isn't that
so obvious, though? I mean, like, obviously that's how classical myths work. I just don't know. I like the book. I have nothing against it, but I just...
Well, it's a comparative religion. I mean, it's a comparative study. He's comparing one thing to another. I haven't read it for a while, but that's the one thing I learned, and that's one thing that Lucas learned.
George Lucas?
Yeah, and it's
Is that who you were referencing?
It's absolutely true. Do you realize what I would have given at certain points of my life to have somebody just say, Will, you, free will as you are, who have such faith in the world, in yourself, you're going to really get the shit kicked out of you right now unless you do what I'm going to tell you. I would give anything right now to have had that.
And to have had that, right?
Yeah, then I could have been a hero. Then I could have, like, blissfully gone my way and had a really nice life, you know?
So what you're saying is it would have helped you avoid those confrontational moments?
God, I would pay billions to do it. I mean, I really, man. Because there are certain moments where you're just not emotionally...
Billions of neutrons out of your soul.
Capable. I mean. You're just not capable of making the right decision, man. And it's just so simple. And but they're never there, man. And that's why myths are so wonderful. And that's why we love them. Because, God, this hero got all the breaks, man. It's great. Hoorah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then, so anyway, to make the one segue. So, Max, who's doing the who's going to interview you for the Writers Festival, Jonah.
Yeah.
He was in here and he got me reading Medea by Euripides.
Okay.
And God, I'm reading this. I'm going, oh man, this is pretty rough stuff, man. But. The whole point of this, in one line, in the whole thing, right? And everybody knows the story, so I'm not going to mention it. But people forget that when somebody says, "Hey, Jason, you know, you're the hero. You got the golden fleece. You're the king, and everything."
Yeah.
You better get back to your house because Medea is up to some bad stuff, right? He goes back there. She has just killed their two sons. He is the king. There is no reparation. She is riding a dragon above the house, above the castle. And she looks at him and says, "Now you will suffer." And she just flies away with impunity on that fucking dragon, man. And that's the element of the supernatural. You know what I'm saying?
Nope. I don't.
That knocked me out. I'm going, wait, she cannot do this and get away with it. But she was supernatural to begin with. And she remains supernatural. All the emotions, all the hatred of the betrayed, denigrated female, and all her horrible vengeance will not be punished. Because she's riding a dragon, man.
Okay, so...
So no cell phones in here, sorry.
Somebody has walked in the bookstore.
Using a cell phone.
And now we will explore the mystery of the...
And it's closing time.
Okay, alright. So, the...
So you don't think that is really spectacular?
I think the idea of...
That was merciful of him. Fortunately, Jonah...
I didn't see his face.
Fortunately, Jonah's a young, tough guy. So anything that would happen, I would say, take you, Jonah.
I didn't see his face. So that you know, that kind of throws me. That makes me think he's a mythological character that has wandered into our lives. You know, he comes in, he says, "Sorry, boss," on his telephone. He's got plans. He's got somebody on the other side.
Yeah, he had the big heavy coat, and he was a big guy too.
Well, he wasn't big; he was just tall. He was right, tallish. Anyway, exactly.
long dark khaki coat. If you see this person, you know, report it.
And it was not khaki; it was black.
It was black.
Yeah, it was black.
Well, I'm wearing dark glasses.
Yeah, you are. Those actually look pretty nice.
I was trying to give him a benefit of the doubt.
Those look pretty nice. Those are pretty nice looking dark glasses.
So great, man.
So
again, back to the dragon. This is the key point I'm trying to bring up.
Okay, where does the
How important is the supernatural in literature, in life, in music, in art?
Well,
because it's the diabolical supernatural.
Yeah. But it's also easy. You know. If you're stuck in a story and then you're like, oh, all of a sudden something supernatural happens. You know, it's kind of like, it's a fun, easy out. You know? You're like, so,
but,
I don't.
But you are, but we're talking about in Greece 2,500 years ago. But I agree with what you're saying. She must escape punishment. That's what's so spectacular about it. And that's the only way she can is through the agency of the supernatural. So, yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. And it,
but that's what knocks everybody out at the end. She kills her two kids and she escapes.
My God. The ethical and moral quandaries involved in this, anyone escaping punishment, oh my God.
For the most heinous of crimes.
Yeah, well, but they were her kids too, right? It's kind of like that, you know, it's one of those things that's not accepted by society, but I think actually has some kind of validity, is if they were actually her kids, well, doesn't she have some right to kill them more than anyone else? I mean, it's like a different kind, you know, it's a different kind of murder. It's like she has more of a right. They were her kids.
Well, that's what she thought.
Yeah.
As a tool of revenge. And that's a very interesting point, Joanie, is that throughout ancient culture, in which power and security was so important, and political power, that the theme reverts where the husband or the brother's life is more important than the children, because you can always have more children.
Mm. That's true.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the greatest insight into historical humanity than anything I've ever read. And
well,
but you wonder, but also it's kind of political art. I mean, this is art that has a certain amount of political support, right? God, we're getting pretty heavy, didn't take us very long, man. What the heck, man? Yeah, I was just reading Mimesis, and yeah, there are at least two of them where the castle is besieged. Their only son has been placed in as a hostage to the besieging forces. And something happens, so the people in the castle say, well, I think we can make it. We're just going to have to, you know, ransom for the boy. And the guy says, no, to heck with it, man. I'm just going to kill him. This was our deal. You would surround the castle, right? And that's what the woman says. This is like 13th century French. We can always, giving up our son will not save us. But we can always have more kids.
Yeah.
I mean, the pragmatism of it is just so astounding to a person of my sensibilities.
Well, it's weird. Yeah, well, it's weird how these moral, objective moral realities, quote unquote, change and to what effect they, or why they have changed. Right. Because that practicality remains.
Right. Right.
Right? It's like, even if you think it's immoral by modern standards, the practicality is the same. Right? And anybody can understand that practicality.
Right. But I can't, you know. I mean, once you have kids, it's like, you just think, hey, you become impractical. You go, they must live before me. Even if I die, you know, in an abstract world, right? In a hypothetical world. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing, man. You just love your kids so much that they are so much more important than you are. And, you know, I just took it for granted. And to read these historical passages in which the opposite was true, I was like, oh my God, you're right, man.
Well, maybe survival. Maybe that's the point, is the author is choosing the opposite stance for the reason of being contrarian, right? They're like, well, most people would think their kids are important, but because I'm taking this contrarian stance, it makes you think of things in a different way.
Sure.
Whether or not it actually affects how you're going to live your life is completely irrelevant.
Sure.
The only thing that matters is that there's amount of plasticity, as they say in brain terminology these days, of being able to think about it in some minorly different version, even if you're never going to act on it in that same way.
Sure, sure.
And I could see that as being a point of myth, is like just engaging with neuroplasticity of, well, okay, so maybe there's going to be a situation you're in where something really terrible happens to you and you just can't have revenge. You can't do anything about it. She's on a dragon. She's flying away. There's just nothing you can do about it. It's just what it is, you know? Like, maybe that is the function of myth, is just to point out when your emotions are just going to fail you, basically. I don't know. Does that sound okay?
You're damn smart, Jonah. You're damn smart. Yeah. I'd never thought of any of this stuff. Well, you're absolutely right, though, and that is just the perverse genius of great writers. I was going to say that in terms of the story of the castle, I was telling you, was that these were high-ranking warlords of the king, and their holding on to that power structure was more important than anything, right? And their honor. They could not give up that castle, and the son was disposable, right? And I was thinking of that, and I was going to make that as a rebuttal, and then what you said is absolutely right. There's got to be some unconscious part of the artist who has suffered deeply and is saying, look, no, you're not invulnerable to this kind of action, man. You know,
it's going to happen to you.
What's going to happen? I mean, how powerful are you? How much do you determine your fate, your emotions, the validity of your emotions? Absolutely, man. That's why literature is just so totally out of control, man. God, I'm glad. This is great.
So totally out of control.
Eric Auerbach is going to be so happy that I mention his name, and I can imagine him thinking what you were just saying, going, yes, I didn't think of that, man.
But he would have to sit through an hour and 5 minutes of other bullshit, so.
We're getting pretty concise.
We're getting much more concise than we were before.
This is like NASCAR, man. We went through... We went through Calaboot and Kundera and who else?
Labatut.
Kundera and Labatut and Euripides. And who else did we get in there?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
I forget.
Yeah. So I think we're doing really good.
I think we've always done pretty good, but, you know, fuck it. Fucking if people don't want pretty good, you know, they want what they're looking for or some bullshit like that, you know, they just want, I don't know.
The lament.
The writer's lament. Why can't I make you think about the opposite of what you wanted to think about? You wanted to think about the way you're thinking about it.
Right,
what if I say the opposite? And now all of a sudden you think I'm the bad guy for saying the opposite of what you wanted to think?
I know, man.
Come on.
I know. Gosh, well, We're not in a bar, but we are drinking. So, yeah, it's like, but yeah, you can just see these journalists, writers, hanging out in a bar and the lament. But you're absolutely right, man. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I think you hit something really important.
But
my question is, Jonah,
yeah,
is this motive to bring out the very underside or antithesis of what we want?
Yeah.
Is this conscious or unconscious in the artist?
That is a good question. Unfortunately, it's one of those ones I would actually have to think about for a minute without saying anything, which would be pretty boring for a podcast.
That's very kind of you. I was very proud of it myself.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it's conscious. I think after a certain point it became a choice, yeah. I think it is conscious.
Hmm.
Because in the classical definition of the unconscious, that's things that are explored in dreams and...
But you do conscious things. That's the point of the unconscious. You do conscious things. And we're looping back to where we're talking about a predetermined, how, what would you change if, you know, you were in high school, whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That unconscious forces of, abandonment, denial, da-da-da, how they determine your conscious choices.
Yeah.
Right. And, yeah, we have to look at Euripides, right? What was Euripides' psychological makeup? What were his childhood traumas that he would pull this trick of putting Medea at the top of fucking dragon and getting away, right? To dismay everybody, right?
Yeah.
To show, just as you said, to show that there is no protection in emotion, you know, in singular human emotion. And we know it's true from history, man.
Okay.
So, I think you're absolutely right, man. Yeah.
So, I'm going to, just for the sake of art, I'm going to go there. Which is, I've had some problems in my personal life lately because I had an affair. And then the woman I had an affair with, she called up Stacy and told her that we had an affair. And was that my desire to do so unconscious or conscious? I really have no fucking idea. I have no fucking idea other than wanting to just be involved with something different every once in a while, you know?
Well, Cohen's a slut, man. just call yourself a slut and call it good. But there is one point that the theme of self, of exposure, that you set yourself up for it.
Yeah.
And some part of you was willing to take that risk. Some part of you may have wanted that to define your relationship or to say something to your significant other, right? So yeah, that's a very good point I'm saying. How much was your subconscious? A lot of it was your subconscious, man. But I hope everything's going okay.
Well, who the fuck knows? I mean, I don't make any money. I mean, this is why I can't feel sympathy.
She should have kept you better.
This is why I can't feel sympathy for these guys who are like selling songs when they're 24. I'm almost a decade older than them now. I haven't sold shit. I, I mean, you know, oh, it seems, oh, that's hard.
Well, maybe this is your book, man. Oh my gosh. Yeah, well, no, I think she just ought to keep you better, man. That's all there is.
I don't think that has anything to do with it.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
It was a joke. And a lame one. Well, you know. Yeah. If you were only King David, right?
If only.
If only you were King David, man. Yeah. I mean, like, yeah.
I would be a good King David.
You would be a great king because you're funny and you're smart and you like to dance, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Saw her bathing on the roof, man.
Does every man who has read that story feel like they would be a good King David, do you think? Or is that only for
us? Well, I think that's a very good point. I think that's why David's so wonderful. We all like to dance, and we all love women, and those two go together. I mean, there are a lot of men that just don't have even the slightest bit of soul in their hearts, man.
Yeah, or they have that insecurity of
Right, that's the point. David really didn't have a hell of a lot of insecurity, yeah, man. Yeah. He just was enjoying life, and he was brave, and he was just having a good time, man. And yeah, that's the beautiful part of Mimesis by Eric Auerbach. He starts with contrasting the Homer and this kind of like panel-like, in-your-face, all these great heroes, right? And in the Old Testament, man, you see David when he's young. You see him with falling in with Bathsheba. You see him setting up Bathsheba's husband. And you see him old and brought down. I mean, that's the fucking genius of the Jews, man. It's like, look, like you were saying, man, how invulnerable are you are.
Are you are.
Have another beer, Will. How invulnerable are you are to the travesties of injustice and age and cruelty and your own stupidity, right? I mean, it's like wonderful. What's wonderful about Auerbach is he really likes the Old Testament, but he really likes the New Testament, because that's when the common man comes in. It's like Peter goes in to find out, okay, his buddy Jesus is like gonna get nailed on the cross, and he goes in to see how things are going, and the servant girl says, I know you, you're one of them. And he goes, no, I'm not. Oh yeah, I do, I know you, you're one of them fucking Christians. No, I'm not. And he's looking around to get out of there. She said, yeah, you are. And by now they're chasing him out the door, right? I mean, it's just this beautiful, real drama about real stuff, man. You know, real people. And yeah, it's really...
I want to title this podcast, R.U.R. That would be a good title, I think.
I liked it, actually, after I said it. I thought, well, actually, it's not a bad line. I think I'll keep using it. R-U-R.
R-U-R.
With the next verb, right?
Yeah.
R-U-R, really confused.
Not even the D on the end. R-U-R, really confused.
Right. Oh, my God.
I like that.
Oh, my gosh.
Well... I had something in the back of my head. I don't remember it now. But...
Well, this is why we love alcohol, and this is why we love Dionysius. And
Yes.
And so you're going to end with a reading from what book?
Well, I deleted our podcast on Sal Bello because it didn't... It never really came together, maybe one day. I mean, it's saved on my hard drive somewhere, but I just saw this as a supplement to the podcast of this being one of my favorite opening paragraphs of all time. We have no theme for this. We've followed no theme for this podcast, but this to me was something that when I first read it, I was like, that's how you write an opening paragraph. Is from Mr. Samler's Planet. Shortly after dawn, or what would have been dawn in a normal sky, Mr. Arthur Samler, with his bushy eye, took in the books and papers of his West Side bedroom and suspected strongly that they were the wrong books, the wrong papers. In a way, it did not matter much to a man of 70-plus and at leisure. You had to be a crank to insist on being right. Being right was largely a matter of explanations. Intellectual man had become an explaining creature. Fathers to children, wives to husbands, lecturers to listeners, experts to laymen, colleagues to colleagues, doctors to patients. Man to his own soul explained. The roots of this, the causes of the other, the source of events, the history, the structure, the reasons why, for the most part, in one ear, out the other. The soul wanted what it wanted. It had its own natural knowledge. It sat, unhappily, on superstructures of explanation, poor bird, not knowing which way to fly.
Wonderful.
I always liked that.
Wonderful. So where did he learn that?
Where? Or how?
Because it's not the Old Testament, four beats, break, four beats. It's like this... It's just like this rhetorical cadenza, right? It's really wonderful, yeah. Yeah, and absolutely so. But again, as you know, I feel myself superior to that sensibility, you know. Because I just don't live it, you know. Mainly because I'm not smart enough. I'm always so happy with my own, you know, predicament that really I never feel that much...
pressure to explain.
You wrote, Jonah wrote the greatest article on me ever. Why is this guy so pleased with himself? I don't know why, man. It just happened. Yeah. Yeah, it's
good. Because you want to live a good life, you know?
No, I'm just not really a histrionic. Basically, Saul Bellow is a histrionic writer.
Well...
I mean, he creates... Wait a second, man. You fucking wait up and you feel unease about your fucking bookshelves. This is really ludicrous, man.
Oh, well, that's true.
You see what I'm saying about the hyperbole?
Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah.
But it's so beautifully written, and he extends it out into the social structure, a critique of the social structure.
Yeah.
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
He's absolutely right, right. You know? So, yeah. That was just my little caveat.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. The thing about
But you have to take a little edge. I mean, if that's what he wants to do, if he wants to write a critique of America, that's the most brilliant thing I've ever read and or heard. And he's got to have a little edge, and he's got to, you know, he's got to kind of shade it, you know, and he's got to set it up, right?
Well, you know, it's one of those weird kinds of comedy. I remember being in the college library, I think last year, and there was one very lithe, very blonde lady sitting at a table talking to a colleague, and you know, she was just talking like she had it all figured out. She was explaining the world, you know, and in that moment, when you see somebody explaining things in that fashion, it's so funny. I mean, it's just funny. It's funny to watch people feel that certainty. I mean, certainty
right.
is
And
funny.
You wish her well, too.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You hope everything goes good for you.
Yeah, like your certainty is good for you for being so certain.
I know. Well, the amount of insecurity behind it. I mean, that's the point. I mean, building.
But it's like, it's such a well-hidden insecurity compared to, most other kinds of feminine insecurity are, like, pretty fucking right on the surface. I mean, it takes 4 or 5 sentences before you see it, right there in front of your face. So, maybe that is the function of the masculine, is to be the sledgehammer against feminine insecurity. Is like they've built up these bricks, and then you're like, no. That doesn't exist at all. Boom. And then they're like, oh, what are you doing? You're breaking it. This is all crumbling.
Yeah, well, men do it too, though.
Yeah.
A lot of men do it too. That's just what Bellow's talking about, Yeah. But you do see, But, I mean, that's the other thing about Saul Bellow. I mean, yes, confession time. My eyesight is going in my left eye. So I go to, and this guy's like a young guy, man. He's really smart. He asks me a lot of questions. He shows me everything's wrong. I mean, what I'm saying is that his construct is right on, He's got the training.
But yeah, he's got the observation. You went to an optometrist?
Yeah, ophthalmologist, yeah.
Yeah.
I only go to doctors. So he's an ophthalmologist. But anyway, I'm just saying that's what I was saying about Saul Bellow. I mean, he's always got this little fucking polemic going. And the basic fact is, man, if you're in trouble, you need to go to somebody who knows what the hell's going on, who has this structure. And the difference between a blonde, like, setting up this structure of reality for her own insecurity, and somebody that's really going to, like, has the training to help you, is really different. And but you'll notice.
Is it though?
Well, you notice does. He slams collegiality, college professors.
Yeah, college.
The educated, the doctors. He slams them.
Well, he's not.
He does.
He's talking about the essence of what the modern condition is. Is the essence of explanation.
Right, but the point is that explanation, if it's right, will help you. Not in literature. Well, even in literature. I mean, I just got done with Eric Auerbach. I mean, and I want to write this great article about two gargantuan intellects ruled Western civilization. Red Auerbach in Boston with the Celtics, and Eric Auerbach.
Auerbach is a funny
name. In Istanbul. And they're probably related, for all I know. But no, it's funny. The reason that Saul Bellow thing didn't go is that I like him. I mean, I think he's brilliant. He's wonderful. But he's just a song and dance man. And I just... You mean, I really like when people just right up front say, look, I'm just going to really fuck with you, And I'm not that skilled on top of that. I really like those kind of artists. And that would be Goya. That would be Hemingway, Van Gogh, Monet. I mean...
But isn't that in it? I've just been writing a story where I did exactly what you're saying. Like, this is what I'm doing. I'm not that good at it. But isn't that in itself a kind of lie? Of, like, a... Or at least a miscommunication to the... I don't know how else to say it, really.
Well, you're getting off in a dangerous territory, because it wasn't what I said. I mean, basically... are you gonna pick a car dealer, or are you gonna pick up pickup game in basketball or football or whatever, you know, and there are two types of competitors that you have against you. And I hate to place literature in a competitive sense, but why not? And there's one guy that's going to say, you know, I'm not that skilled, but I'm going to beat the shit out of you, right? I'm going to, like, be right in your face the whole time. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to, like, swivel around very much, you know. And I'm not going to create something that Saul Bellow does, in which is a rhetorical, you know, program, right? That's so beautiful and so much fun, right? And I just prefer, you know, Hemingway's like saying, look, I'm not that much talented, but I'm going to really kind of tell you what I'm doing. And I also like, who else do I like? I like Zola, man. I
mean, but
like,
Hemingway...
Have you read Emile Zola?
A little, not very much.
It's like, God, man. Germinal is like, are you kidding me? He's like beating you up right away.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no polemic at all. I mean, it's pretty realistic. And so, yeah, I guess I like realistic. Writers. And Saul Bellow is actually not. Everything is filtered through his personal polemic of how sensitive and
possibility of realistic writers has died. It's dead. I mean. Hemingway was getting paid for these little stories. Anybody could have written the stories that Hemingway did. Maybe I'm being a little bit ungenerous to Hemingway.
Anybody could have. No, I don't want to get sidetracked. I'm just saying that I just proved to you that Bellow has got a little slickness in his delivery. He's the rhetoric of it, of, you know, all these explanations and stuff and all these,
yeah,
you know, mental things. He pretty much slants it all as worthless compared to the beautiful soul, right? And that's just what I was saying, is that, you know, really good writers don't do that, man. I mean, they pretty much, like we were talking about, they're always aware of how tenuous their hold is on their own emotions and their own relation to reality, right? I like a certain amount of security, man, in a writer. And I like the fact that this guy we started the podcast with talks about a guy who does everything right, and his wife commits suicide, man. I mean,
in quotation marks.
This is what... Well, I mean, in terms of social status and putting her in a nice home, he's doing everything for her, right?
Well, yeah, also learning how to kill millions of people at the same time.
I'm just saying, man. But what you don't realize, Auerbach... Mimesis is a fucking Prussian Jew, man. But
Read this book.
But he's Prussian first.
Yeah.
He's just like the Jews I knew in America that were American first. They didn't want any fucking fetlocks, man. They didn't, you know, they just wanted to join the country club and,
yeah,
you know, Rodney Dangerfield all the way, man. And, that was what was so cruel, man. It's like these guys gave their soul to the German state. And then all of a sudden it's like, no, actually, you want to get gassed or you want to, you know, wait around. It's just a matter of time, right? But no, I will never like... I love Saul Bellow. He's wonderful, but I will
never... He's a Jew.
No, I will never... Like, there are great fucking Jews, man. They're nothing but balls, man. Isaac Babel... God, who else? Well, Mendelssohn. Who else? Oh my God, Modigliani. Well, there are like thousands of the Itzhak Perlman. There are thousands of the greatest. It has nothing to do with that, man. And I never said that. I just don't like fucking Saul Bellow, man. He's so slick. He's the Bill Clinton of literature. He's so fucking slick and sly, and he creates this. Man, he's like John Updike. God, man. That's why the podcast didn't work.
Whoa.
Oh, I hate to say it.
Whoa.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Saul Bellow's like John Updike. Put on the brakes.
It's the alcohol it's getting to, man. If you wouldn't bring by all this good beer, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the reason it failed, because I just don't like Saul Bellow, and that's the way it's going to go. God, who else, man? Yeah, anyway, I really like it, and that's why I think you're great, Jonah. You're always, like, you know, right there, man. And that's right. Just what I want out of people, man. That's what I want out of everybody. And
yeah.
And writing I don't like getting me to go to a magician who's just going to, like, stand up there and, like, pull fucking rabbits out of a hat, man. I'm sorry, man.
I've got no interest in them. I like magicians. I think they're pretty cool.
Well, at least they're honest magicians.
Well, no. I mean, well, the thing is to learn how to be good as a magician is a completely different task than... I mean, it's dedication.
You are framed as a magician from the first. That's what I don't like about Saul Bellow. He does not frame himself as a magician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
I can see that. I mean, obviously, in his talk about himself, he does frame himself as that. He's like, yeah, I just write stories. I'm not pretending like I'm, you know, a person who's giving facts onto the people. But at the same time, what I have to give as the modern construct of consciousness for most people is most people think about facts. So I am presenting the consciousness of the average person who exists, you know, who thinks about being right, who thinks about what it means to be right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm all with that. I'm just saying that my taste just doesn't go that way. I don't like a lot of rhetorical, I just don't like a lot of rhetorical buildup in literature.
You haven't liked a lot of my writing either.
What are you talking about? Are you kidding, man? I've been your biggest admirer.
I was being...
It's true. It's true, man. Yes.
Yeah.
At all times. I mean, you're a hell of a writer. And you're a hell of a thinker. And you think about things a lot differently than I do. It's like great, man. That's why these podcasts have been such a success. Are we up to like 33 viewers now?
Oh my god! Oh my god! On average, we're up to like 65. Wow! I mean,
that's killer, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, tremendous, man. The ghosts come out of the past. Saul Bellow. Saul Bellow. Yeah, I think it's all about, you know, like in painters, in musicians. I really don't like the suave and the smooth, you know, the rococo. I like more like the body punchers, you know, like, you know, getting into Caravaggio, Brahms. I mean, Brahms was intensely criticized for just, like, really getting into the, you know, the nitty-gritty of rhythmic stuff, right?
Mm.
And the Wagnerians with their... and the ethereal. Valkyries floating above everything, and the good, and they hated Brahms, man. And I mean, God, I just listen to Brahms. I go, around here you gotta play Wagner. It's like, oh God, man. Okay, it's okay, for like 10 minutes as an overture.
I'm not a big fan of Wagner.
Fuck. Oh, it's for 5 or 10 minutes is fine, but I want more than 5 minutes. I want to hang out with Jonah Andrus more than fucking 15 minutes, man. I want to hang out with anybody longer than that. And I get a lot of people that come in here that have that, you know, it's like, oh man, fuck.
Wagnerian.
Just the foo-foo, man. It's like, fuck, it's all perfumed. And
well, they're all Valkyries. Great. They're all mythological creatures.
Oh, fuck. If Wagner would have seen a Valkyrie, his little dick would have just fucking shriveled, man. You know, that's the true story, because basically he's just the introverted masculine feminine, man. I mean, he just wants all this dreamy shit, man. Fuck. Fuck, I can't deal with it, man. I can't even deal with it. I mean, oh God, 15 minutes of Brahms, of anything Brahms did. It was like... But anyway, just to give you some insight, yes, through the whole 19th century, people would get in fights. Oh, Wagner, man, he's the greatest. And there'll always be some little fucking Jew or somebody going, fuck Wagner, man. Brahms is the greatest. Listen to him, man. Listen to how many ideas, how much skill, how much energy, how much, nobility is in everything he does, man. It's true.
I like the idea of the average person on the street giving a shit.
They did.
whether Brahms or Wagner was the greatest.
They did. It's true. Do not take this illusion from me, Jonah. Don't do it, man.
They're like, oh yeah, I saw Brahms once. He's pretty good.
Hey, the Russians are like that, man. They argue about this stuff, or at least we have this illusion. Because it never happens in America. It's like, God, man, I get a...
Oh, you're fucking Marlowe? Poirot, such a pussy. Give me Marlowe any day. I'm an American. You know what you want to read?
You're talking about...
read a mystery?
Chandler's? Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You'd be so proud of me, Jonah. I am reading Ross McDonald, The Underground Man, a more serious and complex writer than Chandler and Hemet ever were.
Ooh.
Oh, and I'm going, oh, come on, man.
That's bullshit, man.
Oh, I know. Serious. And I'm reading and I'm going, oh, this is so fucking phony, man. Ross McDonald's good because he's got heart, he's got feeling, but, you know, no, he's really good. But it's silly to say that, man. But just the whole grammar of it. How about this, Jonah? I should like to venture that Ross McDonald is a better novelist than either Dashiell Hammett or Raymond Chandler. If I ever hear you say, Jonah, I should like to venture, right?
Just, you know, just get come your on. Pistol
what the fuck
out
is,
of the back.
Has he just gotten just published? Just has shoot. He just got an agent? Or what the fuck is going on, man? God.
I should like to venture.
I should like to venture. It's so charming.
That's another possible name for the podcast. For this podcast. I should like to venture.
Absolutely, man. Yeah. That'd be really good. Fuck these people, man. I don't care about them because they're phonies and I hate them. So, yes, on that note, February 8th, 2022.
Is it the
8th? Yeah. I know, man. Mm-hmm. No, man, my birthday's coming up. That's why I'm having such a good time and I'm being so obnoxious, is because I get a pass. It's my birthday week.
Yeah, you get a pass. It's true.
So what are we going to do for my birthday? You and Stacy coming by for a cold barbecue in the back?
For a cold barbecue?
It's going to be cold. The barbecue will be hot. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
It'll be elemental. It'll be an elemental type of situation.
Yeah. Hot barbecue, cold.
Beautiful outside. Women in heavy coats and mufflers and everything, standing around, trying, shaking, drinking champagne. Yes. A typical Will, you know, winter party. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Great, man.
Let's do it. And end the podcast.